From Maria's talk yesterday, the phenomenon she described was the possibility that equilibration from a state point initially farther apart than the final state point might end up being faster than relaxation from a state point that's closer. And this had, in the analysis that she presented, to do with sort of the channels through which the relaxation occurs, right? And beyond that, I'll let her elaborate if necessary. So I was just trying to think of, as far as I understood, and as she also indicated in her talk, this is most natural to think of as an effect that might arise in systems that are characterized by a complex energy or free energy landscape. And so glossy systems are famously those which do have such a complex landscape. And so I was trying to look for whether this experiment, the Mpemba effect, had actually been done for glossy systems, right? And I haven't sort of done enough literature search or asking around to find out. But there is sort of one effect that came up at an earlier point in the discussion. I guess Sid mentioned it during his overview. And I just thought I'll just sort of sketch it very briefly for those who don't know what it is. This is the Kovacs effect. And it does involve some of the concepts that may be relevant for perhaps looking at the Mpemba effect in glossy systems if it hasn't already been done. Okay. So the basic idea is very simple. You start at some high temperature. Okay, so you have a system that's in equilibrium at this high temperature. And then you quench it to a low temperature of your choice, right? And you let it sit there for enough, for some time, okay? And then you increase the temperature to a final temperature, okay? And then in this time window, you ask, what is the time dependence of the volume after I've done this cycling, right?
In the intermediate temperature.
In the intermediate temperature, that's the final temperature, okay? And if you think of the system as being sort of fully in equilibrium at this temperature, right? And that's locked. Okay. Karen, you want to, or somebody? Okay. He's gone. Yeah. So that's not a chair to sit on if you want to sneak away in the middle of the talk. Okay. So let's imagine that we have some equilibrium temperature dependence of the volume of the system, right? And if in this temperature I'm fully in equilibrium, then I'm sitting somewhere here, and then if I ask what's going to happen when I do an up jump of the temperature, which is sitting somewhere here, you might expect that in some way the volume will change monotonically from the value at this lower temperature to the value at the higher temperature. Okay.
What is the system?
It's some kind of polymeric glass, I think, is what they originally did the experiment. People have done this in model systems. So one of the simulations that I'm going to mention was for a model of orthoterphenyl, which is very popular molecular glass former, yeah, and then people have looked at also spin systems, but okay, but what you find instead is So anyway, so the expectation might be that there's a monotonic change from this volume to this volume.
And it must depend on the time, right, that you let it settle.
Exactly. No, I said if I'm in equilibrium at the lower temperature.
Sure, yeah.
And then
you could wait forever if you want, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I waited forever here,
yeah,
and then did the upjump, then
still.
Yeah. Right. But this is not what you do, in fact, because this is a glassy system, so that equilibration time will be very long. So what you find is, if I look at the volume as a function of time, sort of counting from here or sometime shortly thereafter, and if this is the volume at the final temperature, you see behavior like this, right? So the volume actually increases. It overshoots the asymptotic value of at equilibrium at the final temperature, and then it relaxes back, right? And so.
But it's important you have this high temperature first, right? This is
yes.
Important.
I mean, so the system was originally in equilibrium at some high temperature,
mm-hmm.
and you quenched it down to a low temperature where you don't let it fully relax, right?
Oh,
and
but that high temperature can be above the glass transition.
Right.
That's the question.
Yes.
Well, so in principle, okay, so experimentally, I don't offhand recall what the temperatures were, but I believe that they were all above glass transition temperatures, but in principle you can do this experiment even if you go to a low temperature which is below.
But then you need to equilibrate at that temperature.
Well, that you never will.
That's what I'm saying. So
then you do the up jump, and then you should see the same effect. So offhand, I don't remember in experiments whether they did it with TL being below the glass transition. But I don't think it matters.
Okay. Huh?
What matters is that you haven't, in fact, fully equilibrated at TL at the time that you do the up jump. Yeah. So if you look at this point in particular, so let's say I'm sort of thinking about keeping pressure and temperature as the control variables, constant pressure, temperature, well, constant at each segment of that protocol.
On third graph, this time is the waiting time from the first graph, or what?
Why don't you label the time?
Yeah, just label T.
So let's call this T1, and let's call this T2,
okay,
and this can be
okay.
T minus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's after the up jump, you're looking at the wall, right? So if you look at this temperature here, this time here, and you have a situation where the volume of the system instantaneously is the equilibrium volume of the system, but unlike what that should mean normally, there is still dynamics, right? Which means that the system in fact has a macroscopic value which is correct for equilibrium, but the system is not in equilibrium. So this is,
the volume at T final is probably defined in some sort of, quasi-static, that you sort of slowly, that VTF, the horizontal line that you draw, the value of that is probably with respect to sort of a certain process.
Equilibrium is equilibrium, right?
TF.
So, and volume is, there's no ambiguity in how you define it.
When you wait long enough, supposedly if you didn't do the jump, of course, from TF instantaneously, but slowly, then this thing would just, of course, go to what it was before. Yeah.
Right. So now, if I want to think about this, so clearly there are sort of relaxation processes that are happening with different time characteristics, and they are sort of, at this point in time, they're adding up to give me a macroscopic volume that is the equilibrium volume, but the system is not in equilibrium, right? Okay. And so how can one think about it? One sort of very simple intuitive way of thinking is to say that if this is my initial temperature, right?
You mean TH? That's your initial.
This is my initial temperature, and that's the corresponding volume. So I'm starting here.
Yeah, TH.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm speaking slowly.
So one
sort of appealing way of thinking about this is to say that there are different subsystems, right? And the popular way of thinking of different subsystems in this business is to say that there is a structural subsystem and a vibrational subsystem, right? So in other words, if I imagine at a given time that, I mean, this is a cartoon, so don't take it too seriously, but let's say this is the structure I have when I've sort of sat here for this time, right? And let's say when I jump up and I stay till I reach equilibrium here, the correct structure is I have to draw something that's sufficiently different.
Make it long lines.
no bonds, right? Okay, so let's say how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so let's say that's the final sort of equilibrium structure, right, at the high temperature. So what's going to happen when I do the temperature jump first is I'm basically going to have this is like a test of my drawing skills, which are not good. Okay. So I have not structurally relaxed, but I've basically relaxed vibrationally and gone to a larger volume without a structural relaxation. Right.
So the topology has not changed, but my language.
Right. I mean, that's a cartoon for indicating that. So something about the structure hasn't relaxed, right? And on the other hand, the volume, which is sort of a phononic contribution to the change in property, that changes, let's say, practically instantaneously, right? And then I have to go from here to here, and this is a slow process. And these two in quasi-static change of state will sort of go hand in hand, and I expect a monotonic change in properties along the equilibrium curve. But if I'm doing this really out of equilibrium, I don't necessarily expect this, right? So one way of thinking about how to represent this is to say that if I look at the structural subsystem here and I say I'm not going to change that, but I'm going to simply change the temperature and correspondingly the vibrational part of the system's exploration of phase space, then this is not the temperature dependence of the volume I would have, but I would have, let's say, something like this, right? So I do have a decrease in volume, but the decrease along the equilibrium line comes both from just sort of a reduction in the vibrational amplitudes and structural change, which let's say makes the system more compact. Yeah. So for each of these points, I can imagine that I have, and you know, people do these kind of schematics in different contexts. And now, so the time course of what happens if I go from here to a low temperature. So this is now TH. And let's say this is now, okay, TL. So when I do a fast quench, we can imagine that we go from here to here very quickly, right? And then I have sitting here a slow relaxation process that'll take me down here, right? So now, supposing I Okay, I'm going to sort of draw these lines a little bit slowly. I'm sorry, more steeply so that I can... You'll see why. Okay, so supposing I now have come down to some point here as a result of this slow relaxation, and now I do the up jump. Okay, so then I would instantaneously go to a volume like this, instantaneously meaning very fast on vibrational time scales, and then I would relax at the new temperature that I'm sitting at, for which this volume is too large, and then I might expect to find a non-monotonic effect like this. Okay, so this is a possibility. Yeah, okay, so the numerical sort of study that I have in mind said let's sort of test if this is a good picture to have. And so basically, I mean, beyond this, I'll just sort of sketch what the findings are. If you want to sort of talk about slow structural subsystem and vibrational subsystem, you have to ask, how am I going to characterize it, right? So if I imagine that there are components of my system that equilibrate with the bath quickly and there are components which don't equilibrate, then the parts that do not equilibrate fast have to be associated with some additional parameters or internal variables that describe the fact that you're still not in equilibrium, right? So one possible thing that has been explored is the energy of local minima. Okay, so the idea is if I have sort of a multiple minimum landscape, if I'm sitting, let's say, at a given temperature, this is the equilibrium level, and this is sort of the equilibrium kinetic excitation, vibrational excitation. Now, if I do a quench, let's say, to a lower temperature, we can talk about it both ways, such that the vibrational excitation is lower, so this immediately changes, right? But the energy at the minimum does not, and that takes longer times because I have to go and make a transition to a lower minimum, and then eventually I'll sort of end up. So this reduction of the vibrational energy is fast, and the reduction due to transitions between local energy minima is slow. Okay, so then I can think of using this energy of the local minimum as a fictive parameter, as they call it, in addition to temperature and pressure, and say, with these three, I can then explain the behavior of the system. So if I look at the volume as a function of time at this final temperature that I have, I could say that what's changing is this energy. I'm simplifying a little bit because it's unnecessarily... So the temperature and pressure are what are imposed from outside, but this is an internal variable that's relaxing. And at any given time till I reach, till and including when I reach equilibrium, this average, this sort of value will determine what the instantaneous value of the volume going to be, right? So now if I think of then sort of a relationship, which is an equilibrium relationship between the volume. I mean, I've sort of drawn it this way because that's how it was plotted in the paper that these guys wrote. So let's say this is sort of, this is the equilibrium relationship. And so if I, if this is now my TF, okay. if this point corresponds to TF, okay, and let's say I start, how do I do this? Okay, a little tricky, but the point is, if I were to start on this line, so this is now given that I'll fix the temperature and pressure, okay? Then I'm saying that in terms of an out of equilibrium exploration, I still have some notion of quasi-static exploration. Then there is this parametric relationship. And so if I start from here, if my out of equilibrium evolution is sort of on this parametric curve, then I can sort of conclude that this is a good description of the out of equilibrium behavior of the system. I don't offhand know how to write down the dynamics of this, but this is a good description of the behavior of the system with the addition of one internal parameter. Okay, but what you find in these systems is behavior where the energy, so in addition to the volume as a function of time, which is non-monotonic, you also find that this energy is non-monotonic. And there are sort of points on this non-monotonic time dependence, which are sort of not on this parametric curve. Okay, and this means that you're sampling local minima, which are not typical in equilibrium, right? And so the conclusion that these people came to is that a single fictive parameter description is not, it takes you part of the way for small out of equilibrium behavior, but if the out of equilibrium, I mean if the system is largely out of equilibrium, then this is not a good description. And so, in fact, one of the things that they showed is if you look at, in order to characterize this, you can look at the behavior of average values of the energies and their relationship with variances of the distributions. And what you find is that out of equilibrium distributions have narrower distributions in properties. Yeah, so Jim Langer is in here.
Smaller fluctuations.
Okay, and so Jim also has sort of worked with an internal parameter theory. Where they also have the same conclusion, except they sort of tweak their model a little bit more, where there are even more internal parameters that describe the out of equilibrium behavior, and that seems to roughly explain the data. But let us see, what were you saying?
No, I just wanted to comment that we looked at this problem in the context of the PSTIN model that we love so much. And we just reproduce the same protocol. And instead of volume, of course, you cannot look at the volume in that case, but you can look at the energy density
right. That
plays the role of the volume.
Right.
And the model reproduces this hump over there. And you can do it by using temperatures which are slightly above the critical temperature or that are below the critical temperature. It's the same. You will get the same kind of bump. And it scales roughly the same way as it does in all these problems.
when you say model, you mean a model of dynamics? No, or just the... No, so V-spin model is the one that you're looking at.
Yes.
And I suppose you can implement this protocol in the simulations,
exactly.
And you get these results.
It's actually not even simulations. It's the numerical solution
of the dynamics. No, this is what I, yeah.
So this is going to exactly, you have the equations. And then you can solve them numerically, because that in protocol you cannot solve it. Something that it's
no, I just wanted to clarify that there's no additional model of dynamics.
It's
sort of
what is quite clear is that the full evolution takes place very out of equilibrium. So out of equilibrium that there is no notion of a single effective temperature nor nothing of the kind. It's really so far away that it's clear that we will not be able to advocate a single parameter to
what's going on. So the teacher, in the P-spin then is this picture of like there's a structural relaxation. There are two time scales. That's probably
this you can still argue because in that case you cannot think about local degrees of freedom, but you can think about in terms of phase space.
Right. So you're just saying
separation of time scales. Space and separation of time scales and just freedom by the structure of the phase space.
Right.
And if you do it above the dynamical critical temperature, but not so far away from it, so that you have metastable states and all the richness of the supercooled liquid, then it's fine,
and then you
reproduce.
Does that hump depend on the value of P?
Sorry, say that again?
In model, the value of P, does that hump depend on that P?
No, as long as you do, well, a little bit, but not dramatically, so it's not an important parameter, P. As long as P is larger or equal than 3. So P equals 2 is a different universality class, and you will not have this. But as soon as you take P's which are 3 or more, then okay, a little bit the form of the hump will be changed, but qualitatively it will be the same.
With that time scale over which it goes there, is relating anyway to the bare the kinetic constant you have in the P-spin dynamics. This is bare transport coefficient, right? Gamma naught.
Yes.
That point where it cuts it, that time scale has any relation to that?
No, I don't think so, because you can always rescale time, you rescale it out, because you are in the overdamped limit, so the gamma naught is hidden.
So you just plotted E of T.
Right, yes. So I can show you the plot if you wish. This is a paper 15 years ago. That's really long.
So then, Sri, the glassiness is in the separation of time scales, right?
Sorry?
The glassiness, the crucial glassiness that's important is the separation of time scales.
Exactly.
Well, the separation of the time scale is clearly important, but I think the separation of the degrees of freedom for which the different time scales apply is not so simple.
In the P-spin, I don't know if there's such a separation of degrees of
freedom. Not really, because
it's just in phase space.
Yeah.
I can suggest an experiment you can all do tonight, the Kovacs effect. Take a piece of aluminium foil, crumple it, put it in a glass, and replace temperature with load.
With load, yeah, absolutely.
And exactly the same volume will happen. And the reason, again, is the explanation that you have is very good. You have rapid changes in volume that are more or less elastic. But then there are all of these creases that have to change over a very long time, and that's the slow degrees of freedom.
Right, so
no temperature important.
Yeah, no, so Lahini is going to talk in the conference on this crumpling, the Kovacs effect in the crumpling of paper.
So but the
right? Sorry?
Multiple.
Well, so, I mean, the question I want to raise and stop with is if given all of this, if one were to do this simple experiment of starting at two different temperatures, where T1 is bigger than T2, and quench to TF, will you see something like this, right? Depending on the choices. I don't know that this experiment is standard. I couldn't remember having ever seen this. Enzo also couldn't remember anything in spin glasses. But so we're going to look for whether the Mpemba effect has already been studied and understood, at least at this level. But if not, it's interesting to look, because clearly the reason I wanted to mention this is it clearly sort of indicates both the fact that sort of different channels of relaxations operate, but also that out of equilibrium behavior will not lend itself easily to even a quasi-equilibrium description. Uh-huh. Right. So. Anyway, I'm done. So Leticia, did you?
So just going back to the comment you made, and Mara just talked yesterday about why should water do this? Aren't there lots of time scales in water, or no?
Well, so yeah, I mean, in the relevant temperature window, water is a normal liquid, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So. You know, if you take the density maximum as an indicative temperature of when energy-dominated behavior begins to be apparent, so you can think of around zero as the onset temperature of slow dynamics, right? So above zero you have, so you're not very far from the glassy regime,
okay?
But it's the upper end of the glassy regime. You know, it's not deep down. Mm-hmm. And so it looks, and you know, people know all the relaxation times. Mm-hmm. And they're all picosecond relaxation times. So, but I think what would be interesting to do in the water case, mm-hmm. is to separate the issue of nucleation from simply relaxing to a lower temperature. Because of course, that's going to be difficult in simulations because simulation models of water don't crystallize. So maybe one should look at a different model that will crystallize in simulation. I don't think there's anything water specific in this experiment, right?
Right.
Even the original Mpemba effect. Have people done it with other liquids?
We've done it with some, there is one reference, but that was with some granular stuff.
Uh-huh.
Some people, I think Spain or Portugal. It's a very new reference, I forgot. But that's numerics, not experimental.
Okay, but that's interesting.
But Mpemba did it, of course, with milk.
Milk.
Not water.
Which is not water.
Right.
Yeah.
You were suggesting spin glasses. Another place where random energy models is used is protein folding.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm wondering whether in protein folding you have non-monotonic folding times.
I think there could be. I would like to look into something like that. And there, of course, it would be very important. Then you could identify any shortcuts in relaxation. So.
I mean, for protein folding studies, not protein folding per se, right? Because, in the sense that in a cell, this happens on whatever time scale it does.
Yes.
But if you do find that there are protocols where you can actually fold the protein on in silico or in vitro on a faster time scale, that might be interesting. Yeah. Okay, I'm done. So we move to whatever is the next topic of discussion.
So I don't know. I mean, do you want to?
So, earlier I thought, since we sort of stopped a little bit abruptly on the selection experiments of Srividya.
Oh, yeah.
And it looked as though, like this is what Mohitin was asking, that there was some sort of dynamics of anticipating the arrival of the next
batch of food in these growth curves that she showed. It is interesting to sort of have some detailed comparison with the charge density wave memory effects that Sue can tell us about, and then I thought we could. But you telling us about that, the modeling of that would still be interesting. But I guess we don't have the other part.
We don't have the other part, yeah. I mean, I'll just make a couple comments about, I have slides, but I won't do that. Well, they're old slides.
So
they're pretty
sort of introduced it.
Yeah, so I'll I have to do this, sorry. Yeah, but I'll just say a couple things. But I can, I'll just do the board and then if you want the slides. I just have a few. Some of them are scanned in from 1980-something. But, so, and again, we have this problem where we blame the mudslide. But Sri had to go back and was driving to LA, and it's 5 hours on a two-lane road, which means it's not 5 hours. And anyway. But right at the end of the talk she gave, day before, yesterday? Time flies when you're having fun. Yesterday. Or is it the day before yesterday?
Yesterday.
As I said, see? Last year. No.
It is a talk.
Yeah. It was 17 talks ago. There, okay. She did this experiment, right, where she had, she had her, were they bacteria? They were some organism or another, you know, and then she was putting them through the cycle of, like, you know, starvation and food and starvation and food, and then she was plotting the growth rate, right, what the number of things were. And there was something where, you know, things would...
These are actually the sizes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's the size.
Yeah.
So it was like they would go down, but then up. It sort of looked like this at the end, right? I mean, you know, and again, this was time, and then she had sort of a gray. And again, this is just bad because. You can remember it. Good.
Let me sketch what I thought. So these were the starvation windows.
Yeah.
And she had in each of the normal regimes. So if you looked at the mean size.
Yeah.
You had sort of, you know, exponential curves which were intercepted by. Okay, this is not good because she had many of them, and this is one of the questions. So she had exponential growth curves, and then when you hit the
starvation,
she sort of had some very small growth, but then
right,
it seemed to sort of, this is a cartoon now, they seemed to rise.
Right. And the first one didn't. That was the thing. The first one didn't, so the question was it...
So this was, I guess... The next time it was a bit better.
Yeah, right, yeah.
The next time it was. So the question was,
yeah.
Is this.
Is that interesting? Okay.
Analogous to.
Yeah, okay. And the thing is, I thought it was interesting because with the data she showed, there are like many different directions we could go with it. So the one was related to what Mullins was talking about, is it some sort of entrainment phenomenon? Okay. But, and to do that, so question number one would be, like, does it matter how long, so if you change this time and said, oh, we make it either this is fixed or that is fixed or something is fixed, but, you know, is it a period thing and it's just some sort of entrainment phenomenon? And so the sort of the naive person's way, which is the way I think about that question, is to say, oh, well, you could sort of imagine you just have a bunch of guys and they're doing whatever, and then, you know, if they grow before the end, then they have an advantage here, right? And you know, and then you're just getting some nonlinear effect, and it basically everything with growth rate slower than that doesn't grow, and so you know, this is the best one for some reason, and then you can imagine it would just be some entrainment phenomenon, and that would be easy to check because you would just take this time and you would vary it a little bit, and if it changed, then you would know. Okay. But
fixed the time of study.
Yeah, she had fixed it. We did talk to her afterwards, and it was fixed. And it was like, oh yeah, we could. It's like, and that's like class, you know. And that was what Moens was showing about, like the tongues and the Arnold tongues and everything. It's just this thing where you have sort of some natural time scale, and then your experiment imposes a second time scale, and then you can get entrainment for that reason. But another thing that could happen was the stuff that Sri was mentioning that I'd worked on years ago, and is related more to the metastability issue, and there the idea would be like, oh, okay, once it's going, and here you can imagine you have, like, while it's growing, you have some, you know, distribution of some type, that you have a lot of different states that are, like, equally good, and then it's going through some second thing where it's sort of it's going into one of those states in some arbitrary way, but then by repeating it, you end up in some special metastable state. And it's sort of from the point of view of the mechanism of the experiment that Sri was doing, I'm not exactly sure how that would work out, and I didn't ask her enough details to be able to say something. But then this Sri said, oh, well, I'll just talk about the old days of, you know, the metastable states. And it's relevant because, again, like Sid and Nathan Keim and, you know, a bunch of people have done various analog things of this type. And so I do have data. So data definitely works, really. All right. And again, you can then see my age. Oh. But I did bring the adapter. Okay.
You want the screen down?
Oh yeah, we'll need the screen down. But there are only a few, so I promise it won't take too long. Why? It's up, my computer is doing some whack thing. Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. This goes in here. And it's just gonna work, it looks like. Yeah, no, it looks like it's just gonna turn on all by itself. But maybe not. See, it looks like it's on, but I don't see anything here. Does anyone know? Does anyone ever figure out? Oh, sorry?
Yeah. Do you need the...
Do you actually need... Yeah, because this was on, so we thought it would just magically work, but...
Yeah. Wait, is this...
I don't, well, there's this remote, but that one is for changing slides.
Yeah, this one is, it looks like it's warming up right now.
Okay, so you think it should work all by itself?
Yeah.
That I won't have to touch anything?
Yes, it should, because it worked for another slide, or another presenter earlier. But it's just warming up. It takes a couple of minutes.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully.
Let's skip that. I'll show the data first, I think. Okay. Yeah, if you look at it here, you would think it was working, but. No, oh, no input is selected.
Okay.
I do have a different adapter, which is not this kind, this is VGA.
Okay.
I do have the other one of the other kinds. Should I do that instead?
VGA actually worked earlier, so.
I'll get my other guy.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so I don't know what this one's called, but this one's this one, right?
Yeah, HDMI. That
let's see if that is that one. No. I'm gonna. Oh wait. Oh.
Does it look like it's working on your computer?
Yeah, it is. So I'm looking at my display. Security, keyboard, start. Oh, here's displays.
Yes. Of course.
Yeah, see, because it says optimized for Xtron. Yeah, so it thinks, and mirror displays is on. So I don't know. You know what I mean? Because my computer knows that it's connected. Should I hold on to this guy?
Yeah, I think the HDMI one. I think you'll have better luck with
that. Better luck with VGA.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, someone had told me I needed to get a HDMI, so I'm very disappointed. But yeah, because again, my computer is like definitely knows there's a that it's talking to something. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Is there another talk?
It's a discussion.
I'm serious. I was walking around looking for someone, and there were people in there.
I know, and it's like, I know. But next week, I guess there's the conference. But then after that, we're going to impose discipline. Well, I'll just sort of say words since I don't have the data. So, and again, what happens is that there is a synchronization thing that happens in this experiment that maybe you will see. But again, it's not a frequency thing, you know, because the stuff that Mons was talking about, you know, there are two frequencies and they're either, you know, related by small fractions or they're not. Where here, you have sort of, you turn something on and you turn something off and you turn it on and you turn it off. And when it's off, you can leave it forever and it's fine. You know, so it only cares about like, there's like an on state and it only cares about how long the on is. And this in the experiment was actually checked because, you know, they just left it overnight and came in the next day. And, you know, so it had been off for a really long time and it still looked exactly the same. And now it's because this is a system. All right, I'm going to put this up and I'll just do it on the board. And then at the very end, you'll see the fabulous data, which is. Okay. But I will cheat and look at my slides. Yeah. So anyway, and again, and this was means this was back in the day, and so the material. So these were nonlinear conductors, and they were called charge density wave conductors. Okay. And one of the great things about the experiments in the meantime. Oh, great. Thanks. Yeah. So you have a choice, and my computer knows. Oh, I didn't touch anything there. That's probably good that I didn't.
Do you
want
me to put
a screen on? Well, I don't know. Do you want the screen? Yeah, I'll do the screen. Okay. Yeah, I was just didn't want people just.
Yeah.
Did that do it?
The middle light.
No, that doesn't look like it did it.
PowerPoint?
That is PowerPoint, yes. Yep, you can play from current slide.
For some reason, it's not sensing.
Yeah, no, and the thing is, like, the computer knows it's connected, because when I went into the displays, it said, you know, optimize for.
Right.
But we can blame Tim Cook, right?
Let's try just mirroring the display and see
if that works. Oh, go ahead. You can escape it.
Escape.
Oh, how do you escape? Now escape. I tried that. It seemed to be mirroring. Yeah, it is mirroring.
Yeah.
At least the computer thinks it's mirroring.
Well, mirroring is different than opening the display.
Yeah, here. It is right there. Oops. Yeah, that one. Okay, and if you... Oh, wait, now it's in, optimize 4, but now, I don't know what happened there.
Is that different dialects of the, or is it just...
That's the external display, it's not mirroring.
Okay, so...
It says minus 5.
Okay. Did that do that?
Do we have another connector?
Oh,
you've got the funny.
Yeah, it's like the lousy new Macs.
Let me try it. I've got another one of these, and that's the only other thing I can try.
Okay.
Because it's not even mirroring, so. On the right input. This is input number 3.
That's right input?
Yep. It was switched to the wrong one. Let me try another cable.
Okay. All right. Should we give up? Well, no, I guess they're going to all this trouble. Now we have to. Now you have to wait. Someone has to wait. I'll wait. That's why you didn't know. Yeah, but see, I had. Oh, right. You didn't. You just sort of said, well, it looks like this. Should I do that? I could do that. And then in the end, whatever.
You want me to put
the screen? Yeah, let's put it up.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, I blame Tim Cook.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Anyway, so it's this nonlinear conductor, but they have the property that thermal effects are, unless you go really far out of your way, thermal effects are really very negligible. And so they're sort of a trivial glassy system in the sense that, like, the only thing that matters is, you know, sort of the very fast stuff that goes downhill, and then it never manages to get over a barrier to first order. And then, you know, sort of the upshot is that sometimes interesting things happen even when there's no relaxation at all. Okay, so what you can do is, there are a few materials that have this. Okay. Okay. So that and okay. And the way you can model it is and there's like a mapping which I won't do to you. But you can think about it this way, that there's like, you know, a bunch of balls and they're connected and each one's in a periodic potential. All right. And then, you know, this is connected to the, and there's some elastic coupling between them all. And then you can, it's coupled to a field, and then when you put on a field, everything just tilts, okay? And for ease of drawing, typically what people do is they just put everybody in one potential. But the actual model, you know, every ball has its own periodic potential, but the period of each one is the same, okay? Okay, and then again it tilts. All right. So what the experiment is you just take the thing and you cool it down, and then you turn on a field and you turn it off, and you turn on a field and you turn it off, same field for the same amount of time, and it's a pretty big field, so like it's, you know, everything slides. So you should think about it just going downhill, stopping, and then if you are able to get the projector to work. What you see is you do some time average. Okay, so this is a time average experiment where you put on a bunch of these things. And so, you know, so you would have a square pulse like this, and then you would measure the current. So you put on a voltage, measure a current, and you get something that looks, I drew it wrong, sorry, like that, okay? And I can do this better. There. Okay. All right. And so, and again, this is really very intuitive if you think about the balls all start off from the bottom. Oh, totally overdamped. There's some inertia, but totally negligible here. Okay, so again, the velocity is the slope. Okay, so what happens is you start at the bottom, and here you see the slope is... the slope of the potential is zero, and then you start from the bottom, and then you start again. It's tilted, okay. But here you're going uphill, right? So the velocity goes down, right? So that's what this is. Velocity always decreasing because everybody starts at the bottom, and then you start going uphill, and everything goes down. And then what happens is all these guys go slowly out of phase, and so then the oscillations decay, and the experimentalists were starting. Oh, and I should say who the experimentalists were. Sorry. And so this is an experiment by Fleming and Schneemeyer. Okay. Right. And so they were like studying like the frequency, and so like this is fine. And then you say, oh, and this frequency just corresponds to, you know, how long it takes for every particle to move one wavelength. Great. Okay. But then what they did is they made the pulse a little longer. Okay. So then if you do this, and actually I'll just show you the really long one because I'm having such trouble drawing everything. We'll do a different color because they have a. Okay, so it looks off. It starts the same. It does this, and again, everything decays because it gets out of phase. But actually, there's one which, you know, and it does this. Okay, and when they had the long one, it was like really very clear because these had sort of decayed, and then you're like, well, why does the velocity want to rise at the end of the pulse? Okay, so it's so it's a different kind of synchronization. Okay, and the reason we know that is because then after it's off, you know. You put this on, you put it back down, and this time can be varied, and if it makes absolutely no difference to the result of the experiment, as long as it's long enough that everybody relaxes back down. So that is sort of the do you want me? Oh yeah, no, I'm here. Yeah, and it is plugged in. Okay, so I broke it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a real theorist. See, I didn't even have to really do anything, and I broke it. So, um, So that was the mystery about, like, why would it care about what happened at the end of the pulse? And now there's step one is like, well, how does it know when the pulse is going to end? And that is clear because you put on a sequence, right? You put on the pulses are the same, okay? And then there's like more to the story, and we put on different length pulses, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to talk about this. Why does the velocity want to rise at the end of the pulse? And so then again, if you ever see the data, actually I'll do this. I unplugged it, sorry. Maybe you can see it and maybe you can't. It got smaller, let me escape.
Did you try the VGA?
Yeah, we tried the VGA, we tried the other.
I do have another VGA cable.
Oh, you want to try it?
Might as well for grins at this point.
Okay, no, I think I broke it. But it really didn't do anything.
It's not responding, so I think.
Yeah.
If you want to move into the SSR, I think that's.
It's not worth it. I'll tell them about it, and it's never as good as. Okay, so this is.
And try this one.
Oh, I see. You had already.
This is the same thing. This isn't VGA. This is the same.
Oh, okay.
You can try it.
So it's another. Okay.
One more.
Right, and mine are all black, so I won't steal any of yours because I bought black ones.
I just don't. I think the projector is just needs to be rebooted, but I can't get to a ladder, so.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Oh, so probably it was the guy before me who broke it.
Probably.
Yeah. Great. Okay. All right. We're giving up. All right.
Sorry.
So here, let me. I'll show you like this. Okay. So here's the one you can see, and now it's. You can't see it. You'll just have to trust me. Oh, you can see it, yeah. And so what happens is like you change it and you say, oh, okay, well, it would be, you know, if I went to this point here, the velocity would be going down, and then you go there and it all changes, so the velocity's already always rising at the end of the pulse. Okay, and so, okay, so now I will skip forward until, you know, and we were all puzzled and all that stuff. But I'll skip forward to the end of, like, how in the end we understand it. And the way we understand it is in terms of a metastable state selection. Okay, there's a dynamical selection of metastable states. And so I guess we're going to look at one guy. Well, actually, I'll do the single degree of freedom thing to give you some idea of what's going on. So, so you have one guy here, okay, and there's, you know, it's connected by springs to neighbors, and as long and the thing is, there are many, many different places this guy could be, and now I'm thinking not when the pulse is on, I'm thinking when the pulse is off, the metastable state after it relaxes and it just goes to the nearest minimum. Okay, and there are many places this guy could be, all right, and then the natural thing to say, and many people do say this, is, oh, well, it'll just sample this randomly, and it doesn't, okay, and actually this happens even for one degree of freedom, where if you took that guy and you connected it to a nail, okay, and we actually wrote a paper on this, but just to show you, in the old days, you could write papers on things of this type. Okay, so you have a guy like that, and what happens is that when you do this, this guy can be in some large, there's a metastable state. This guy could be in many, many different minima. Okay, but on the other hand, that's not what's happening. Is that you started off, and then there's some evolution. And in particular, you could take this guy and then just put him on the nail, and then start doing this experiment. And what happens is that you tilt it, the guy moves over, and then it falls down to the nearest well. And then you tilt it again, guy moves over, falls to the nearest well. But while you're doing that, the string is stretching, and it'll just sort of keep moving over, go down, move over, go down, but then you finally stretch the spring enough and it goes up and goes back down. And the trick is that once it does that, it stays there forever. Okay, it's just like when you lose your keys and you're looking for them. When you find it, you stop looking because you found them. So what this system is it's looking for a fixed point. It's starting not at the fixed point, and it keeps evolving until it finds a fixed point, but by definition, a fixed point is when it stops evolving. So as soon as it finds a fixed point, it stays there. Okay, so, and this is very similar to the marginal stability, it's sort of reminiscent of the marginal stability hypothesis where, you sort of have some region that is the fixed point region and you sort of always come in and you're evolving in some sort of semi-continuous way and you end up on the edge. But that does not explain the experiment. Okay, what that does is sort of gives you some sense of why you don't end up in a typical place. And what was unusual is the fact that you couple all these guys together and they all do it. Everybody ends up in a marginal place. And again, if I had things, we were able to get where, we do a simulation, and this is like back in the 80s when it was all on a computer with 56K of memory, but it didn't matter. It's remembering the good old days, right? They all have this property where, what happens is they all end up here, you can see near the top of a potential well, okay? Oh, and I naturally erased it, sorry. But you remember I went to great lengths to tell you that, well, okay, if you start at the bottom, the velocity is falling, right? But if you're at the top of the well, the velocity is rising for all the same reasons, right? Because it's minimum here, it's maximum here, so when you're at the top, the velocity is rising. And so if you have the selection that's causing you to be at the top, the velocity will always be rising at the end of the pulse. So when you change the pulse, then you the whole thing reorganizes, okay? So there's something about the dynamics that, picks out a special subset of the metastable states that the system can have. Okay, so let me do this picture a little better because this you can see looking at one degree of freedom. Okay, so, and again, it's this guy's stretching, and the way you can think about it is like, in terms of the big system, instead of the nail, it's like the neighbors, and everybody's doing it at the same time, but, okay, morally speaking, hopefully that's clear. Okay, so you've got this guy, and again, the point is that you have this stretch spring, okay, and the question is it going to go backwards or is it going to go forwards? Okay, and what happens is if you stretch it more, it's more likely to go backwards. Okay, and so it's actually quite trivial to show that the place where that where that decision point is always on the top half here.
And that's why it's
going to
go up.
Yeah, and so the decision point is on the top half, and if the decision point's on the top half, that means that it's actually like this is just sort of a statement in the sense that there are these springs, but Newton's third law tells you when you calculate the average velocity, the spring forces fall out because every spring force is equal top to somebody else's spring force. Okay, so the only thing that matters is like what the potential is doing when you're thinking about the average velocity. Okay, so it's like really like for this thing, it's like really trivial to show that you're on the top half, and then like 20 minutes later, you've proven it for the whole system. You know what I mean? That on average, you're at the top. Okay, and so again, that's this picture of if you're on the top, the velocity is minimum at this point, maximum at that point, therefore the velocity is increasing at the end of the pulse. Okay. So what do I think? Okay, so I don't want it to go on too long.
But then you said that you make the pulse long.
Right, and what that does is that the spring will stretch a different amount. In the big system, the what the fixed points are, the configurations that are all the fixed points change because it depends on what pulse you put on, whether or not things are rearranging or not. You know, because if you have like a super short pulse, then lots of things, lots of things don't move, right? And like if the pulse is zero time, then everybody just stays where it is, and every configuration is a fixed point. But as you make your pulse a little longer, you get some of those configurations, the guys make it over the top, and now they're not fixed points anymore, and the thing sort of evolves until it finds a fixed point.
So there is, in some sense, if you ask yourself, just right before the pulse ends every time, what's the configuration, and then what's the configuration the next time the pulse ends?
Yeah.
That kind of implicitly defines a mapping on these configurations.
Yeah.
And so the shape of the mapping, you know, so that mapping has apparently a pinch point, as Sue was saying, and so, you know, as you keep on doing this, you drive the system. So you look basically, what's the configuration right before I turn the pulse off? And then the mapping is, you go from this time turning it off to next time before it.
Yeah.
You see how this comes. So this is a map on the configuration itself. And so the pulsing is just you reiterate the map, and the thing apparently it has a fixed point, so you get to the fixed point. But the shape of the map, you know, what the map exactly depends on the pulse length.
Yeah, right. That's the point. And then there's one follow-up paper on this particular thing, actually, like with pair and...
But this overshoot, does it depend on how high is it? Does it depend on the pulse length as well? How much does it rise?
Oh, okay. That is a great question, and has a long answer, which is mostly just sort of like me saying hand wavy bullshit. What we were able to do is if you make the springs weak, then you get everything is, you know, right at the top, but in the experiment, the physics of the experiment is actually you're in the opposite limit, but it's believed in that it flows to strong coupling, and therefore it depends on the details exactly how high this goes. Okay, so in other words, it sort of depends on how strong the pinning potential is relative to the spring constant, but there is a limit of large spring constant where it just everything is in there, and then, you know, it goes to one. Oh, sorry, large, small spring constant, large pinning. Yeah, okay. In that limit, everything organizes, but you have sort of effective degrees of freedom if the pinning is not strong. Okay, and that was the trick in doing the simulations on a, it was actually an AT&T PC. It was really quite amazing. I mean, there was actually, like, somebody had a game of Pong that, you know, worked with a system clock, and they needed to find a really slow computer. And so we were able to give the computer away eventually to someone who could, you know, anyway.
Program it then in BASIC or something? Or?
Yeah. they didn't call it the good old days for nothing. Anyway,
they didn't call it the good old days for nothing.
Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, this thing that the dynamics, you know, again, totally, there's no relaxation, nothing thermal going on, but what happens is that, you know, the driven dynamics drive you to some, you know, unusual place, okay? And and in this case, there was like a signature that the system knew, you know, was encoding these memories. And so from the point of view of the workshop, and, you know, the sort of like, that to me, what's interesting is that, like, I'm sure these memories are hiding in lots and lots of physical systems, and that's why I was like really interested in these experiments that Sid did, where, you know, he encoded them, you know, in a colloid, and, you know, and the various ways of, you know, showing that you have a system which is, you know, has many different possible configurations, and it's picking one out, but, you know, that I have no doubt that information's in there, but how do you ever read it out? Okay, and Sid and Nathan and various other people who will be coming will be doing like a lot of different experiments where you can actually get the glimpse of how to read it out, and that is why I, you know, decided I was willing to talk about this, because again, it's sort of like, you know, one of the early examples of something where you just say, oh, okay, you have like a, you know, what looks to be a complicated system, but it's definitely remembering something, and it's not just exploring some landscape in some organized way, but it's actually, you know, starts off really organized in a way that is not obvious, and you know.
So, but in some sense, then you have kind of, you know, if you, the basic ingredients. I mean, maybe if I can sort of.
Yeah.
You have a landscape of lots of metastable states,
yeah,
and so on. I mean, the states are basically the configurations, yeah, of this whole assembly there. The pulsing, basically, you know, the periodic pulsing, or at least the sort of, in this case, the window on which this time is on before you turn it off for an infinite depth, induces some form of mapping. All these landscapes. Maybe you say to me, you know, at the last, right before off, you had this configuration, now you get this one. That is depends on, you know, that mapping depends, of course, on the particular system or whatever, or
yeah,
whatever you have.
Yeah.
But there's some form of mapping. And in these cases,
yeah,
so the forcing, or the forcing protocol, selects a certain form of mapping for you. And then you evolve according to that map, and if that map has certain features, like it has a fixed point, and if this fixed point,
yeah,
is a global attractor or something like this,
yeah,
then you get these,
yeah,
you know, then everything essentially then depends on what happens right before the stuff is turned off. In your case, before the stuff is turned off,
right,
you get a boost in the...
Right. But now it's like, yeah.
It's periodic, right? If it wasn't periodic, you wouldn't see...
Well, what happened, okay, so now I'll just, okay, I want to say a couple other things, and then we'll go home. We won't go home, but, you know. So one thing is, I did want to mention, so there was a follow-up paper that Per and Chao Tang and Kurt Wiesenfeld wrote, and Peter Littlewood, I forgot to mention Peter, I'm so sorry. All the theory I told you was done with Peter. Anyway, but there's one paper where there are the five authors, and one thing they did that was really nice is they said, well, don't think about it in terms of the positions of the particles, but think about it in terms of the spring forces acting on each particle. They called it the curvature because it's, you know, xj plus 1 minus 2 xj plus xj minus 1, if in one dimension. We've done it in more dimensions, it doesn't matter, but okay. And this is a discrete curvature, but this is just the spring force on the particle. And what happens is then, you know, again, it's sort of like if the spring force is too negative, it you know, you don't stay in the same well. And if it's too positive, you don't stay in the same well. So there, it's like really clear that the fixed points have the topology of a hypercube, because basically every spring force is in some range, okay? And again, what everything I told you is telling you is that you end up on the corner, okay? And again, as you add more degrees of freedom, the amount of face space you actually explore goes down exponentially, which is sort of interesting. You know, again, it's a very strong selection. So I wanted to say that. But then relevant to this other thing is that then, like, I don't know, like 10 years after we did this work, not quite, but Sid said, you know, it's a memory, right? It remembers how long the pulse is. And he says, well, what if you gave it more than one thing to remember? And this whole thing I told you was in terms of fixed point selection. So I said, well, I haven't done it, but I guarantee you it will only remember one thing. And it turns out that in a limit of long times, now this is, I think, relevant to some of the stuff that we were talking about, that Sri was talking about earlier. In a limit of long times, that is true, but the actual, in the transient, it remembers lots of things. You can give it a bunch of different pulses of different lengths, and you'll get the same thing where the velocity is rising for a while, okay? So then we actually talked to a guy named John McCartan, who was a Clemson. He didn't get tenure, but I don't think it was my fault. But he did an experiment looking for this, and what he found was that, yes, indeed, you do the same thing where you just put on different length pulses, and the thing didn't forget. It always remembered. So it just kept remembering lots of things. So then we were like, oh my God, now it's remembering lots of things. Why is it remembering lots of things? And it turned out that if you add noise, you can stabilize them. So you have things that look like they should only be transient memories, but if you add noise, you can make them permanent. So I could tell you, anyway, so that's sort of like the prehistory.
So does noise help you to remember more than one
thing? Well, basically what happens is the problem is like when you hit the fixed point, you're done. And the noise keeps you from hitting the fixed point. Okay, and as long as you're searching, you're not dead, right? You know, there's some like sort of philosophical analogy, but just like losing your keys, right? You know, it's like somehow as long as you keep losing them, you can lose them in different places, And that was the trick of if you needed enough noise to keep it from actually finding a fixed point. Because again, if it found the fixed point, you'd be it'd be done. But still, like, not so much noise that you lost it altogether. And it turns out it is possible to do that. So you could take a system that even only transiently remembers stuff, and you can make it so it'll do it forever. But he didn't get tenure, but again, in the meantime, then there are the other experiments that other people have done, and you know. But again, I think this idea of sort of thinking about the dynamical systems aspects can be really interesting. And again, and I think of it as different from the mode locking. I don't know. I mean, it's.
There is some similarity.
It's related, but different enough that...
Here you have an energy.
Yes. And the thing is that while you're moving, it's a very strange energy because it's unbounded. But in the metastable states... Right, and so what happens is in the experiments, you focus completely on when it's moving. And then in the theory, because of this thing of having an energy functional, you focus completely on the... metastable states, because there you really have control, and that's why when people sort of say, "Oh, you minimize, the energy or whatever," again, in the metastable states, it's the high, these states are the highest energy metastable states it's possible to have. So it's like it's an anti, something, maximum entropy. The entropy is zero, and the energy is as high as it could possibly be. So, anyway. Yeah.
I think I understand your one-dimensional version well, but I don't understand the other ones.
Yeah.
Can you mock up the one-dimensional version to learn multiple things with noise?
Oh, you mean this guy?
Yeah.
No. What happens? I think I'll make you. I'll go offline because the temporary. So everything I told you about the permanent memory is correct, but what happens is when we found out about this that you could remember for a while, it was this. How do I want to say this? It turned, because I drew this as like you would just come from the outside, but what happens is that the curvatures turn out of the right variables. And you can look at the dynamical equations for the curvatures, and basically what happens is the curvatures, they tend to increase, but then there's also the other curvatures, and then you end up getting these funny cycles where, it goes forward and backwards and forwards and backwards, okay? So they tend to hang up at these sort of boundary places, okay? So if you think about, like, having pulses of different lengths, the one that's the most... restrictive is the longest length, because in the limit of infinite length pulse, it just goes to one unique steady state. Okay, but while it's still going and these shorter pulses are, doing their thing, what happens is you still get the same mechanism where, they sort of get hung up, right, at these decision points for the individual pulses. And as long as you can keep it where it doesn't get so close to the fixed point that those guys aren't relevant, then you can sort of have them all do their thing. But it's sort of the same mechanism, but you have to sort of formulate it dynamically because you can't actually be at the fixed point. Okay. That was, I didn't think that was clear, so the fact that you nodded made me happy. Okay. I think we're done. I mean, we've